Welcome back, everyone, to another episode of Cinema D'Amore. I'm your host, Chuck Phillips, joined by
your host, Justin Morgan.
And we're still snowed in. It's still freezing cold outside. Nowhere to go for the holidays. Still just snowed in and thinking about ways to pass the time.
And this week, small little town.
Yeah. And this week we passed it with Sam Raimi's A Simple Plan, which is we won't jump straight to like the conclusion of this, but like by the time I got to the end of this movie, I was like, we picked like really, I don't know if it's just the idea of being snowed in just makes things so much more depressing. But we just really picked a streak of like these films all end with just being on real down notes. They don't end in positive ways at all.
In fact, cold. I mean, that's kind of
it's what it does. Yeah. It just makes everything worse. It just you can't have a good time in the snow.
Snowed in that definition feels like trapped. We're trapped.
You're trapped. Yeah, and that's how all three of these films we've done so far. Really give you that trapped feeling and everyone just scrambling trying to make it out alive. And in all three of these films, not many people make it out alive.
And if you're in our podcast, you are trapped with us.
Yeah.
Technically you can turn it off, but why would you want to when you can be trapped with us?
This was actually the first time I watched this movie. I just knew it had the snow like winter setting when I picked it. I've had the movie for years and I just never got around to watching it. So I figured this was a good chance to finally get into it.
Oh, wow.
And I really enjoyed it. I think this is like the only Sam Raimi film I'd never watched previously. And I feel like it is one of his, like, I don't want to say like lesser ones, but it doesn't feel like it's not the first thing you think of when people bring up Sam Raimi. You're always going to get either his horror films or you're going to get Spider-Man trilogy first when people think about him, and then you have those other movies interspersed in there, which I feel like is a disservice to Sam Raimi that he doesn't get enough credit for being just in general a great director that's really talented in a lot of different genres. Like I feel like everyone only wants to bring up Evil Dead and Spider-Man, but they don't think of like For the Love of the Game. He's done sports movies. He's done The Quick and the Dead, which is a great Western. The Gift, which is a psychic paranormal thriller, something like this, a neo-noir thriller. Like he's done so many different types of films. Yeah, Oz, he got into, you know, even more straight up fantasy films. Like he's done so many different things that I just feel like he doesn't get the people overlook some of these smaller films of his and only want to focus on some of the big ones. Or like Darkman, that was his first try at a superhero film, making his own wacky superhero.
Yeah, and it kind of like correlates into Spider-Man. I feel with A Simple Plan, the reason why it seems to be so under the radar is it does not feel like Sam Raimi. It has almost a completely different style to it.
Even it makes Danny me feel more of Coen.
It does. It's this.
It has more of that noir Coen feel to it.
Yeah, it has a Coen Brothers vibe to it. Danny Elfman does the score, but it doesn't really sound.
It doesn't
like
even sound like a Danny Elfman one. Yeah,
No.
Everything about this movie like goes against your expectations when you first look at it.
I mean, it really does. Like Billy Bob Thornton plays a role that you don't normally see for Billy Bob Thornton.
Yeah, much more like grounded character. He's usually kind of playing those really like strange and out there, like way over the top personalities. And this one, this is like his most realistic feeling character that you actually genuinely have emotions for. I feel like you care about a lot of the characters in the movie, but he's definitely the standout, I guess, or the one that it has the most engagement with you, even more than Bill Paxton, even who's the lead.
There's so many people in this movie too. I noticed I was watching the credits and I saw that the production coordinator I worked on Fences with worked on this movie as a production coordinator. And she probably has brought this up, but, you know, she'd always be like, oh, yeah, Sam Raimi, he's awesome. Like just name dropping people. Yeah. I also did see that that AD, who's in a lot of trouble because of the Rust movie, not checking the gun.
Yeah.
He's in the,
he was working on this.
Yep. Dave Hall saw his name on it.
There are a lot of guns in this movie, so, you know, luckily no one died there.
Yeah. And, what's her name? Becky Ann Baker, who plays Lou's wife. Also, if you watch Girls, it's Hannah's mother. I'd actually worked with her on a show for a little bit, too. And it's like that name didn't stand out. And then when I saw her, I'm like, oh, my God, you're in everything. And you don't even know it's her until like halfway through the movie, because she doesn't even have a close up until easily more than halfway through this thing.
Yeah.
But even they're all like, the cast is really, really good. We don't see a lot of, is it Brent Briscoe who plays Lou?
Yeah.
You don't see him in very many things. I know that he was one of the actors that had passed away when they did Twin Peaks, the return, the last season of Twin Peaks. Remember how before it came out, because they were shooting it for so long, they're like, this actor died and this actor.
Yeah.
He's like one of the four actors that died. Died the same year as Bill Paxton, actually. Hmm. Billy Bob Thornton's the only one around of the three.
Yeah. This definitely, this is one of those films too, though. I feel like when you go into it, you know who's going to be the one that's not going to make it. When your main cast is like Billy Bob Thornton, Bill Paxton, and Brent Briscoe, you're like, I don't think Brent Briscoe is going to make it to the end of this film. I just got a bad feeling. He's not a big name, and he's not on the poster. I don't think he's gonna survive.
Did you know much about the movie going into it? Because I feel that makes this movie 1,000 times better, not necessarily even knowing where the plot's going.
Yeah, I didn't know anything about this movie other than I can remember vaguely as a kid seeing trailers for it, and just kind of, like I said, in general, I knew it had a winter plot, and there was something about money. Like, I couldn't remember if it was like a bank robbery. I feel like I had a vague, that was my thought, was like a vague recollection of it being like more of a, like they stole money like from a bank or something like that. So I knew next to nothing about this movie other than who was in it and that it was a Sam Raimi movie.
Yeah, it feels pretty grounded in reality for the most part. I buy that like Wisconsin, Missouri vibe, you know, where they ended up shooting it in this like small little town.
Gives it kind of like a Fargo feel.
It has a Fargo
feel. It's around the same time.
Yeah, and it has this really nice, it's like the small town mentality, morality thing going on. And I think that's what makes this the most fun, is because every twist and turn is something with, it's like an ethical choice, you know, every moment, and it escalates, and it's always like, all right, am I going to be selfish, or am I going to think about other people?
Yeah. Yeah. I like it doesn't go too crazy into like neo-noir territory. It's very light on that. It doesn't go full-hearted into the, you know, narration over the entire film from the main character. It doesn't get too deep into that. We get an opening and closing narration from Bill Paxton's character. But yeah, the way it gets into those kind of like shades of gray in, even from right off the bat when we meet these three characters, and the way they set up them, you know, tracking down and finding a plane out in the middle of the woods in some sort of preserve, and, you know, they find the money, and two of them want to just take the money immediately, and Bill Paxton tries to kind of be the voice of reason and give all these excuses for why they can't, you know, that someone's gonna be looking for it, it's dirty money, it can't be, you know, someone will come after them if they find out that they've stolen it. And he keeps going back and forth, and really takes a lot of convincing from the other two that it'd be in his best interest to take the money, and that they're going to take it anyway, whether he wants to or not. And they'll just keep him out of it and split the money between themselves if he doesn't take it.
I really like the idea of how things have consequences in this one, such as basically the entire plot build up to the fox that killed that hen, and it ran out in the road, and that's how they ended up breaking their car, and the dog chased after that. So that's why they went out into the woods and happened to come across the plane. And then later, when Bill Paxton's talking to his wife, Bridget Fonda, and they come up with the idea that they have to put some of the money back, they have to find something, some money, when they find the plane, or else they'll know somebody had already found it. So they make their way, he makes his way back with Billy Bob Thornton, and that other guy's looking basically to kill that fox that's killed all his hens.
Yeah.
So it's like, I like how that put that guy out there and made sense for him to be there too. And they didn't have to do that. Like, it could have just been some dude on the snowmobile, like, what's happening, guys?
Yeah. That whole scene with the guy on the snowmobile, this is almost where you get more of that. Sam Raimi likes to do it, but he also, I feel like, does pull that Coen Brothers influence, because he has worked with them in the past, and I think he was definitely influenced by them. But there is a lot of, like, black comedy that pops up in this movie too that's really great. Like, when Billy Bob Thornton hits the farmer over the head with a tire iron, and then he thinks he killed him, and Bill Paxton just starts driving away, and the guy just looks up and goes, "What's going on?" and he falls off. Then, like, rolls him off to the side. Like, there's just that, like, comedic look to it, the way he's driving with that guy just hunched over the front of the snowmobile. But yeah, I love, like how you're saying, everything has its consequences and impact. Like, Billy Bob Thornton freaks out because he thinks he killed the farmer because he just couldn't think of anything in the moment. But he was alive, so then Bill Paxton has to kill him because, like, you almost think, like, that the farmer will wake up and go, "Oh, what happened? I don't remember how I got here." But he wakes up immediately and goes, "Your brother hit me in the head. We got to call the cops. You got to call." And he starts, like, freaking out. And Bill Paxton's like, "Oh, I got to kill this guy now. He knows too much. He didn't forget just because he got hit on the head."
And Billy Bob Thornton's character is wonderful too, because the fact that he's has a very low IQ, and even his friend Lou has a low IQ. It's early on that we know that he has loose lips. So he's somebody that has to be watched. He's like an additional problem for how things could possibly go wrong.
You get that immediately when they go to drop Lou off, and Bill Paxton's like, "Lou, you can absolutely not tell your wife about this money." And as soon as he walks up and he's like, honey, I got to tell you something. And Bill Paxton's just like, he's telling her right now. Like, it's like immediately. He's like, he's telling her right now. Like, I know he is.
Oh, and he absolutely did.
Yeah.
And then too, when that sheriff showed up and Billy Bob Thornton's talking about the plane, and he's like, "What plane?" He's like, "I don't know what he's talking about."
Yeah.
Bill Paxton tries to shut it down.
Yeah.
But that's a good suspense moment too, when they terribly cover up that money and the dog just starts, like, messing around in the, like, it's going to easily knock off that cover where everyone can see the money.
Yeah. That's what you're waiting for. Yeah, and I like the way
that way plenty of times throughout.
Yeah. Yeah, they feel like, again, the way they build these characters, they do feel like anybody that's lived in a small town, you feel like you know all of these types of characters. Like, everyone knows, you know, the couple guys in town that are the town drunks that, like, don't have anything better to do. They're always in the bar all the time, just sitting around. They don't do anything. I also enjoy some of the other, like, minor characters that they randomly throw in. And I feel like the one I've dealt with the most is the old man that comes to the feed store. And I feel like I have to explain things like this all the time. "Yeah, I buy feed every Monday, and you charge me for 10 bags last month instead of 8. And Bill Pax is like, "There's 5 Mondays in December, sir." And he's like, "You're trying to tell me there was 5 weeks last month?" And he's like, "No, sir, I'm trying to tell you there's 5 Mondays in December. Go look at the calendar if you don't believe me." Then the guy looks at it. He's just like, "Are we good, Mr. Smith?" And he just slams the door as he walks out. He's like, "I guess we are." Just those kind of characters. Like, everyone's just weird there. They just all have their little, little oddities. Accurate. Yeah.
You said it. Yeah, absolutely accurate. Yeah, there's just so many great moments in this too. I almost feel this is one of the few movies where it's just great moment after great moment after great moment. And it always starts over again fresh. So when they're, like, worried about Lou, because Lou has already, he's about to lose his truck and everything. So he's really getting desperate. So now you have Lou, who's desperate, Jacob, who is loose-lipped, and both have low IQs, and those are what's that Bill Paxton's character has to work with to kind of keep this a secret.
Yeah.
And I just think that that all snowballs in such an elegant way. Particularly the scene where they try to trick Lou and get him on a recording so they can kind of keep him, you know, under their thumb.
Yeah. Yeah, that whole scene's fun. Although, I have to say, we've skipped over a little bit of the build up to that, and we haven't brought up
a lot.
I know we've skipped over a lot, but the other primary character in this, which is Bridget Fonda, who I think plays a great she's playing in the noir sense, the femme fatale sort of in this whole thing. She keeps constantly giving Bill Paxton all this advice for things that he needs to do after he tries to get her to admit that she would keep the money, which she says, no, you can't keep the money. That'd be wrong. And he's like, are you sure? What if it's like drug money? It's not hurting anyone. And she's like, no, you can't steal money.
Every time but you as give soon me advice, as he, somebody dies.
Yeah. As soon as he dumps the money on the table, she's like obsessed from that moment on. She's like constantly thinking about all the ways that they'll get away with it and all the things that he needs to do, telling him to. Yeah, she's the one that tells him he needs to put the money back, which the only reason they're out there to put the money back results in the farmer getting killed because he gets too close to knowing. Then after that, she starts telling, she's the one that comes up with the plan to trick Lou into admitting to the murder, which again, yeah, results in more deaths, I do like that line. I got a plan. Oh, really? Who's going to get killed with this plan? She's an interesting character. She doesn't have too much to do in this movie. She kind of almost always is just there to complicate Bill Paxton's plans, essentially, which, like I said, again, she kind of just plays that femme fatale role of just constantly being in his ear and telling him all the things that she thinks he should be doing, and you know how he's not doing the plan right. He needs to do it this way. He needs to change this. You can't trust Jacob. She's always trying to like turn it around. It feels like in the end she desperately wants the money pretty much to herself by the end of it. She's always trying to like get everyone else off of it. Even like dealing with Jacob, Bill Paxton's plan is to take the money and leave, which it 100% sounds like Jake and Lou would not leave. They would both stay in town, which Jacob makes very clear when he says he wants to buy his family's old farm, and which Bill Paxton keeps telling him, you know, how are you going to explain you suddenly have like hundreds of thousands of dollars to own a farm? He's like, oh, we'll just pretend your wife inherited money and you bought the farm for me or something like that. And he's coming up with all these excuses to just stay in the same place and just suddenly have millions of dollars at his expense.
He also has a lot of really great lines, particularly the one where Bill Paxton's trying to be like, you know, dad drank all the money away. And he's like, you think he drank the money away? It went into you going to college. That's where all the money went. And that's why this house looks the way it does and wasn't upkept.
So there's a lot
like that.
He has a bunch of those moments where it really does. You start to feel bad for Jake because it really feels like his brother just like pretty much dismissed him. Like probably that's how it was as soon as he went off to college and, you know, got an education and then came back, and he always looks down on his brother and, you know, seemed to just ignore everything. Yeah. Ignore the fact that his father, you know, mortgaged their farm to send him to college, which then in turn is probably, as Jake says, probably what led him to kill himself, which Bill Paxton has like no clue. And he's like, what do you mean he killed himself? That doesn't make any sense. And, you know, Jake kind of like points out, oh, what do you think? He just like suddenly forgot how to drive his truck on that road that he's driven a million times. You think he just suddenly like forgot that there was a curb there and, you know, drove off the cliff by accident? Like, no, he killed himself. He has a lot of those moments that, yeah, every time he reveals a little bit more, you get a little bit more insight into Jake. You feel more and more sorry for him. even has that one story about, you know, if he gets $1 million, will girls like him? And will he get a girlfriend? And like, he reveals that he's never been with a girl. And that one girl in high school, Bill Paxton's like, no, you're with that girl, Tracy, or something like that. And he's like, no, her friend's just better $100 that she wouldn't actually date me for a month or something like that. And like, kind of just made fun of him. And like, you feel really sorry for him at that point, that that's what his life is just living in a little shack with his dog. Like that's all he has to look forward to every day. And you really understand why he makes the decisions he makes and why he's so quick to join in with someone like Lou, because Lou's like on the same level as him. Like you said, they're both kind of like, aren't the smartest guys in the world. And he feels his brother's always looking down on him. So he has to join up with someone else to kind of balance it out.
Right. It might not be intentional either, but I always like the idea of perspective, and it doesn't feel like it's a lot of exposition. It always feels like in this movie that it's building towards the characters. So the more information you get, the more it builds who they are and doesn't necessarily have to play into the plot. And the only time that ever comes up where there's plans, simple plans, they're only ever brought up because they never go right. Anytime that there's a plan, it just doesn't happen the way that they planned it out.
Yeah. Yeah, all of their plans keep falling through every single time.
Yeah, they're all terrible. When you say fall through, it is literally... somebody usually ends up dead. Yeah. I felt watching this movie too, that there's so many bodies at one point that I'm thinking, how could you even talk yourself out of this one?
Yeah. Yeah. And every time every time there's another death, the brothers have to keep, figuring their story out every single time. That's like another like recurring moment, is every time something happens, you know, Bill Paxton starts saying, okay, so this is how the story's going to go. Like, this is what we need to tell him.
Almost immediately.
Almost immediately, every time.
Somebody just drops dead, and they're like, okay, here's the story.
He's always prepared, yeah. So when the farmer, when he drives him off the embankment on the snowmobile, and then he gets up to the road with Jake, he's like, okay, so this is what we're going to say. We weren't even here. We were just driving along the road, and, you know, we might have saw the farmer driving. Yeah, and the same with Lou. All right, this is how we're going to work the story out. You went and got your gun, and he went crazy, and he killed his wife. Which that's another.
I think for Bill Paxton's character, actually does do a good job of trying to think things through the best that he possibly can. You know, when they went back to the plane to put more money back in it, they had to have a reason for being out there. So they're like, we'll just fake this, you know, tire being flat, and we're fixing the tire. Yeah. But then after that, Jacob had killed that guy, the older farmer guy. Now it's, how many cars passed on this road? I don't know. Jacob, was there any cars? Did anybody, yeah, like, see you here? And it's like, maybe a car. It's like, you're not really helping me out. Like, he's not getting the idea of where the concern is.
Yeah.
But he's trying. Like, he does try. He just doesn't,
yeah,
quite understand.
I do. I think my favorite scene in the entire movie is that scene at Lou's when they go in and try to trick him. Because the way it plays is so perfect. Because Jake's already unsure about double-crossing Lou, because he feels like Lou is like more of his brother than Bill Paxton is sometimes. Like, the way he's always been separated from him. And it seems like he is gonna like ruin the whole plan for him. He's not gonna do it at all. He's just gonna, you know, throw him under the bus and, you know, go against his brother. And the way that scene just keeps building, it starts getting like really cringy and awkward. The way, you know, Jake starts to like mock his brother, and he's like, "Oh, you drink whiskey like a guy in a commercial. I don't even think you're sipping it. You ever see someone do that?" And he starts mocking his brother just like endlessly on and on, like really egging him on. And you can see Bill Paxton's like,
his feelings, yeah,
yeah, yeah.
Sorry, you can tell that's where you were going.
Yeah, you can tell Bill Paxton's getting like really uncomfortable watching this and starting to feel real bad. And then at the last second, Jake like turns it and goes, "Oh, you know what? I bet he'd go in and probably confess to the sheriff on Monday. Yeah, yeah. Uh, t- tell me how it would sound, Lou. Why don't you tell me how that would sound? You do a good impression when you're drunk. Like he's at the last second, like turns it on and gets him to go through with it. But then you like really see the
Edgar Allan Poe-ish or I don't know, Shakespearean, like that whole, yeah. that whole idea of like the setup and the betrayal. It's the, everything is perfect. I remember watching this scene in college where they were just basically building up the direction. And it's one of those moments where like, it's one of the longest scenes from there until all the chaos like happens.
Yeah.
And it's all just like a step on top of it. And I think if you're looking at like emotional beats, it is like an excellent scene to watch because just the way that power struggle happens like continuously between the three characters and essentially fourth character. It's just impressive all the way because you don't realize how much time has passed and you would almost feel like there'd be three or four cuts. And I mean, there are cuts. There's cuts continuously between yeah. characters, but it escalates in real time. That's what I'm trying to say. It moves yeah. naturally to where it needs to go, and it goes spectacularly terrible.
Yeah. Yeah. That whole setup's good. I do like how, like the way Jake plays it. Again, Billy Bob Thornton's great in this movie. Like I said, how he turns it and gets Lou to admit to it. And then you just see in the end, like he's the one that feels the most hurt out of this whole thing that he even had to do that. And he kind of tries to justify that, you know, that his brother told him that he would help him buy back the farm. And that was like too big of an incentive for him to pass up. He can't take the risk that Lou's going to ruin it for everybody, that he'll lose his one dream, his one chance that he has to actually make something happen. And then it gets more into that, again, that black humor slapstick kind of things going on from there. Yeah, when Lou pulls out his shotgun and starts threatening him.
You felt slapstick? I felt like legit fear, like legit tension.
Not his moment. It's not till the wife shows up. No, there's legit fear and tension when Lou's threatening him and threatening Bill Paxton with the shotgun, and his brother has to save him. But no, when the wife comes down, and when he approaches her, grabs the shotgun, and she immediately runs away, and he's like, "No, I wasn't gonna shoot you. I wasn't gonna do anything." And when he shoots her with that shotgun, and she goes flying into the window and bounces off of it. That's the slapstick like dark humor moment. That's just a really, really great moment.
Very intense moment.
The way he shoots her and she just goes flying backwards, like lifts her clear off her feet into the cabinets in the window behind her. After she tries to shoot him with a pistol and misses him all the way around
three or four times.
Yeah. It feels like Pulp Fiction when she's just like firing off that gun and not a single shot hits him, and then he finally like collects himself and just takes one shot at her.
Yeah, it's wild. From the betrayal to the tension when Lou finds out, to the tension when Lou feels so threatened that he ends up getting a shotgun because he's really been pushed into this corner financially. Could there have been a better way to go about it? Absolutely. But the movie never does go that route. Because I feel like you could say, Lou, listen, let your truck go. You can buy another truck once this all clears. You know, just deal with it for a little bit. We're sorry that you have to lose it, but it's too soon.
Yeah.
Or maybe we can try to help you. Although Bill Paxton, the only time he does try to help Lou, he gives him like, what, $10?
$40.
Or something. Yeah, $40.
Yeah, $40. What is this? Yeah, which then he lies to Lou because he tells him he doesn't have the money there. He says it's a day's drive away in a storage locker, but we see later that it's right upstairs. It's probably like in his closet. It's not far away at all, but he's that dead set on not giving, not breaking with what his word was, that they needed to hold on to the money until the plane was discovered in the spring. that he just still, he keeps insisting that he'll burn the money if anybody, if anyone even remotely starts to snoop around, or if he hears any word that, that something suspicious is going on, he'll burn the money immediately.
There's a lot of fun with that character because there's always this constant sway where I feel he kind of gets excited about the fact of the money and the dreams of what he can do with that money. And then you kind of have, like, it swerves into the selfishness aspect of it a little bit. But it doesn't land too heavily on the idea of more for us. The only time that is ever brought up, I feel, is when they're joking, like, you know, well, if you don't want to be a part of it, me and Lou can split it, and that's going to be more money for the two of us. But he seems to be, to me at least, pretty dead set on splitting it evenly.
Yeah.
But yeah, he feels that he's, I don't feel like he's wrong in feeling the way that he does, but he feels like he's the only person of the three that can really hold a plan together.
Yeah, he tries.
And yeah, he tries, and he's not always the best, but he's the best one out of the three for the job.
Yeah, and then once we get into like the final section of the movie, I feel like they've really done a good job so far of, again, the way Bill Paxton's character reacts to his wife coming up with her plans, and he's always like, "Oh, your plans that always get everyone killed, like, you know, who else is going to die this time?" And they set it up that she's been wrong about so many things with the way she keeps going about everything. That when they get to that last part, and now suddenly there's an FBI agent, which they keep setting up really well. I love the sheriff that's just always kind of there towards the end. He keeps popping up more and more. You know, at first it seems like he's not sure about the two brothers' story about what happened at Lou's house, because it sounds like some their story doesn't like 100% match up. They told it slightly different. And then when he shows up at his house the next night and Bill Paxton's like panicking, and then he's just like, "Yeah, I don't know. I found your brother drunk at Lou's house. Like, you might want to take care of him." And he's just like, "Okay, that's all it was." And then when he shows up at the barber's and just keeps like pacing back and forth behind Bill Paxton, who keeps trying to like look at him, and the barber like keeps pointing his head forward,
making bad jokes, yeah, about his hair thinning,
and yeah, keeps mocking him, like the sheriff that just keeps showing up, and then tells him, "Oh yeah, there's an FBI agent."
Yeah, your wife, after you get to the wife's theory, which you can go ahead with.
Yeah, that they've set her up to be so unreliable, and now she's panicking, saying, "Oh, I bet this guy's not even an FBI agent." And they set it up really well. Even like they show you that real grainy picture that, you know, you really can't tell anything. Bill Paxton's like, "I don't know, the guy was thinner that I saw, and he didn't have a beard." And she's like, "I bet he lost weight and shaved. I bet he's not." And she's completely panicked out of her mind that this isn't an FBI agent, that it's actually one of the criminals that got the money for a ransom, which we didn't mention earlier is what the money actually is. It's for a kidnapping ransom. And she believes it's the brother.
They don't even really find that out till the end.
No, not till later. But yeah, like I said,
you do have to bring up the fact that she's like, "Did you see his badge?" He's like, "No, I didn't see the badge." So when he gets back to when he's supposed to take them out to the plane, and he gets back to the police department, and he's talking to the sheriff, and I love when he's like, "Did you see his badge?" He's like, "No, but I've seen plenty of them."
Yeah.
And he goes, "Well, do you think he'll let me see his badge?" And he's like, "You're really excited about this. Maybe I'll drive you around and I'll turn
the lights on." Yeah. Yeah. We'll drive around town and I'll turn the lights on and everything for you. Yeah. The way the sheriff's like constantly like mocking him,
like condescending him, like yeah, he's a child.
Yeah. Like he's just one of the locals that just doesn't know anything. And yeah, but the way they get her character to that point that I kind of did the same thing. As I'm watching the movie, I said, "No, that guy is going to be an FBI agent." I said, cause she's been wrong about everything. She's always been, you know, she's too quick to come up with these crazy ideas. Like, I bet it's probably, and her big plan is like, "I'll call the FBI tomorrow." And it's like, I feel like if someone actually worked at the FBI and like a random person just called and said, is there an agent with this name? They would just be like, I don't know who you're talking. I don't have like everybody's name here in front of me. Like, I don't know who all works here. But yeah, she panics and tries to call to warn him not to go out there, which he doesn't heed. He kind of feels like he's trying to protect everyone around him, even like the sheriff, because he kind of says that to him, like, well, you know, what about my brother? And she says, oh, just tell him he was hungover and he couldn't go with you or something like that. So he makes that excuse. And then he's like, well, what about the sheriff? Like, I can't just let the sheriff go out with this guy. If he's a killer, he'll kill the sheriff while he's out there or something. Even Bill Paxton is usually trying to look out for other people in some way. Like, so he decides that he still has to go out. I feel like the one thing I thought that, not to say, I guess, felt like unrealistic, it's like when he's walking around the sheriff's office and there's big glass windows and I'm like, no one's like looking in and seeing Bill Paxton just like rummaging around in the drawers of the sheriff's office. Like, we see there's other people out in the waiting room area.
I don't feel like it was too crazy, because I feel that it was like small enough of a town that no one cares. Like, it wasn't a concern.
Yeah.
Although you think they would be interested in like, oh, there's an FBI agent here.
Yeah, that more people would pay attention to what's going on.
Yeah, I do. I mean, I love it, too, where he grabs the revolver and then he's trying to look for bullets and he finds his, like, junk drawer full of, like, all different shapes and
sizes. That feels like a great, like small-town sheriff thing of, like, he doesn't have boxes of ammo. He just has a drawer full of loose ammo that's, like, for all different cartridges and all different sizes. There's not, like, a single consistent bullet in there. It's like, it feels like every time he just has like one left over in a box, he's just like, I'll just toss it in the desk and I'll have that one for later.
Yeah, it's a great moment too, because he has a gun. You don't know if he has ammo.
Yeah, and or if he's going to figure out the right ammo.
Yeah, if he needs it. And then when he's out there, and I like when they split up, and he's like, I'll fire my gun, and you can have this whistle.
Yeah,
like, it's like...
yeah, you get the little whistle to play with. And then, yeah, Jake shows up, which is like he's like, oh, what are you doing here, Jake? He's like, I talked to your wife. And he kind of like looks at him like, about what? What do you mean you talked to my wife?
Yeah, like, don't tell me. I mean, I'm curious, but I would rather you did not ruin this.
Yeah. Again, like I said, all the way up until the moment that Gary Cole sneaks up behind the sheriff, I was still like, is this going to be are they going to fake you out and Bill Paxton's going to like pull out that gun and shoot him and he actually is an FBI agent? Like, I feel like that's a scene that they could have really played either way. They could have like set it up that guy was an FBI agent and Bill Paxton pulls that gun out and shoots him. And then the sheriff looks at him and is like, what's wrong? What the hell's wrong with you? Like, I can't believe you just killed that guy. And, you know, then he just goes to prison immediately or something like that. Like, that's how his end. And it would just set up that the wife like led him wrong again, one more time.
I mean, this has a better setup, I think.
It does have the better ending.
I do enjoy too. When he shoots the cop, the sheriff can't understand what Bill Paxton's trying to say about watching out for himself. And at gunpoint, he takes Bill Paxton, and Bill Paxton has to go into the plane to get the money. And the only thing like that kind of threw me off was like how he let him stay in the plane with like the door shut.
Yeah. Which, like, why wouldn't you look in?
Yeah, like, why wouldn't you constantly be watching him? But you did add to the tension with like the bullets. I also thought he was going to do something with the plane, with the way that the plane like was like a seesaw, how it kept like falling back and forth. I thought like the guy would go in with him and he'd like try to like,
they would like throw his balance off. Yeah. Something like he could like flip him over. They might have thought about that. I don't know. That might have been like a thing that they thought about, but then just was like impractical to try to film that.
It's a great moment too, of jumping back when they find the plane and Lou throws that snowball and it just knocks all the snow off the plane. And they're like,
oh yeah, that's a good shot. I guess the only way the way that I kind of thought about why Gary Cole stayed outside was, I guess like maybe he, in his mind, he would have to keep watch because Jake's still out there and he has a gun. And if he were to like happen across, obviously, there's been gunshots already and Bill Paxton and blew his whistle. So it's like you would presume that Jake's going to show up eventually. So I guess that's the only thought process of why he would like let Bill Paxton go in there so that he could keep watch. Yeah. So he needs to be there to make sure that Jake doesn't like come across all this and shoot him before he can get him. But that moment when Bill Paxton steps out of the plane and pulls that gun on him after he throws the money down. And I love Gary Cole looking at him and just going, "You don't have the guts," which it's a good moment because obviously just all the info you have as a viewer, we know he's already killed people. Like he's killed two people already. Like he's not above. And these were people that he actually knew and probably cared about. Like he's obviously clearly not above killing anybody else. Especially this random guy who's a criminal. And when he's like, "I guess we got a lot of explaining to do." And Bill Paxton has that great line. "Nope, just me."
Yeah, it is a really good moment. And then you have that like really bittersweet, sad moment where him and Jacob are talking and Jake essentially can't continue to lie. Like it's just way too much for him.
Yeah.
But I mean, we also kind of learned too that all this money is essentially, as Hitchcock would put it, a MacGuffin.
Yeah. It's useless. It really
plays no importance at all besides pushing all these characters' decisions.
Yeah. The end is pretty perfect for this movie. Again, like I said, for the third film in our series of Snowden, where it just ends with everybody being in a terrible place. Most of the cast are dead at this point.
It's not yet. I think that's the one thing so far that is it's not that it's just depressing. Literally in the great silence, everybody is fucking dead.
Yeah.
Except for like a handful of people.
Yeah.
And then in the thing, everybody's dead and two people that will probably end up being dead killed.
Or they're aliens or they're the thing. And then this is just everyone that Bill Paxton knows and cares about is dead, including his brother, who he had to kill.
You're dead inside.
Yeah, basically. The setup at the end when he's in the office with like the actual FBI investigators that come in later on, and they start telling him, they're like, there was $4.4 million, and they're like, we couldn't mark it because we were worried about that. He's like, but we had guys looking and they marked 5,000 serial numbers. He's like, that's like 1 in 10 of each bill. And basically just like, as soon as Bill Paxton knows that, essentially it's not that everyone died in the movie. It's that we find out they all died for absolutely nothing, that Bill Paxton will get absolutely none of this. He doesn't even get to keep the money, which was like his only reward in the end for all of these deaths and murders that he had.
You don't get a reward when you're bad. We don't reward bad behavior.
That is the movies. Yeah. That is the lesson that he learns at the end of this film, is that literally is, to put it in the most simplest terms, the moral of this movie is crime literally does not pay.
Yeah. I think it's a brilliant screenplay. Even that moment at the end is great because it is a little bit of a roller coaster ride, like a mini roller coaster, where the first thing they say is like, they didn't have time to mark it. And you have that kind of like, awesome. Except we did count, you know, like $500,000 tops of some of the serial. Like we had time to write down some of the serial numbers.
And it's too random. He can't risk spending even one of those $100 bills, because if it pops up on somebody's radar, the way the FBI guys like it's bound to pop up. Like he's like, you can't spend that much. You can't spend $4 million without eventually we'll track down one of those bills and find it.
So they're all gonna, you're all gonna stand out somewhere.
Yeah.
I honestly, this is one of the scripts where I am jealous. Like I wish I could have written something like this, because it has that perfect roller coaster ride where everything builds off of the previous scene and everything builds very naturally, but it's just not straight tension the entire time. And yeah. usually when it's not tense and we have these moments of like more emotional beats, they're always really fucking depressing too.
Yeah.
It's the snow, like you said. Snow is
it just
literally gives you the blues.
The I own the book. I didn't get myself enough time to reread it when we decided.
You sound like me from last week.
Yeah, when we decided on our thing, because I know it's the author was the same one that wrote the screenplay from his book.
Oh, that's who that was.
It is the same. It's the author. The only other big thing I know he did that, which I did read his other book, which is The Ruins, which was made into a movie as well. I don't think he worked on that screenplay, but that book was like very. Very good. I really enjoyed that book. It's
is that the movie from like?
It was like the early 2000s.
10 years ago, or
it's
something.
Like, it's like these people are in South America and they find these like ancient Aztec ruins, and then they're like trapped there by. Essentially, it's like a sentient vine that attacks them, and kills them, and it tries to like infect their body, and then once it infects them, it like more or less it's almost kind of like a thing where it tries to like make them like leave, like it wants to spread itself out and get off of this ruin that it sits on, like which sees the local villagers have like kept it in check with like fire, but they can't. I guess they like couldn't kill the whole thing.
A lot more detail than I thought you were gonna give for
the ruins. It's a good book. It's a good book.
I remember
book.
Like
I really
a trailer I thought of them being in South America, like you said, and I remember like I didn't even know it was roots, but I thought it was like someone's veins or something were like getting real dark.
Yeah. They like looked at it. Yeah. It looks the way I didn't watch the movie, but I can remember the trailers. Like it plays out a little differently or looks differently than it looked in the trailers, I guess. But it's kind of what that is, but it is a fantastic book. And I assume Simple Plan's also a great book too. I am interested to read it at some point to see what, if any major changes, he might have used or might have put in there.
I mean, speaking of great books too, when we had Lexi on last week, that podcast, they sent me like a gift basket for being a guest. And well, I'm bringing up the book because she found I Am Legend for me and sent it to me so I could finally read it. So I can read these other short stories of Richard Matheson that I hadn't read. But I had guested on Godzilla, Dune, and I did one of their little horror things where I talked about Michael Myers, and they literally found something from each thing for me. Like, I'll show you, Chuck. Not a lot of people can see. There's a Michael Myers pin when I talked about Halloween. I have the Godzilla coin. There's no batteries in them, so I don't know if he works yet, but he comes and takes your coin.
Yeah.
And sand from Arrakis.
I like that.
I said, how the hell did you... I'm so impressed. How the hell did you find something... Like, some of that seems very obscure.
Yeah.
But anyways, I'm usually on the same boat as you. I'll have the book. I have a lot of stuff that I'm like, oh, I can read that. But I still haven't read Frozen Hell, which I think I have for another 2 weeks, but I do want to read that one too because it seems interesting and I've watched that movie so many fucking times.
Yeah.
But I didn't even know Simple Plan was a book. Yeah. I know they were a band.
That is true. Yeah, that's probably the first thing that pops up when you search Simple Plan is 100% going to be the pop punk band.
It's a mixture of Bill Paxton and the band.
Yeah, a little bit of here, a little bit of each. But yeah, I don't, like I said, I really enjoyed this. Again, this was like the only Sam Raimi film that I had never really watched before. And I think it's definitely worth checking out if you're a fan of any of his other stuff. Like I said at the beginning, I 100% feel like Sam Raimi doesn't get the respect. Like he feels like he's a very underrated director. Like I said, that if someone says Sam Raimi, the first things that you're going to think of is pretty much Evil Dead or Spider-Man. Those are like the only two things that pop up to most people's minds. but I've really enjoyed all of his all the movies that aren't those two, that aren't Evil Dead and aren't Spider-Man.
What's your favorite? Do you have a favorite?
I really like The Gift. I think The Gift
is really... I wish you were like either Evil Dead trilogy or Spider-Man trilogy.
Either of those. I think Drag Me to Hell is a great, another great horror film that I feel like didn't get enough praise when it came out, even though it carries a lot of similar elements to such a mostly like Army of Darkness in the same kind of his weird, crazy style.
The humor that really plays into
Yeah.
The overabundance of blood.
Yeah.
I thought it was wonderful when I saw it. I didn't know. I think I was thinking when I went in, it was going to be another one of those like shitty horror films that tried to be scary, but never really was.
Yeah.
And within a couple minutes, you realize that the entire intention of this movie is to just have a lot of fun.
Yeah. Just be a fun movie.
Yeah. That was it. And it has one of the best endings.
Yeah. Yeah, again, and I'm hoping now that he's doing the new Doctor Strange film, I hope that means he's going to start directing some more, because that was a 9-year gap between Oz and this film, and he's just been like producing.
I do remember he was doing World of Warcraft for a long time, and then it fell through.
Yeah,
so he might have put in several years there, and. I don't know. They just announced him recently for Doctor Strange, but we know that he's been on that for at least 2 years, if not a little bit longer, because I think Scott Dickerson was on it, and then I don't know if they told him not to be a part of it, or it sounded like it wasn't really his decision.
Yeah, it sounded like another kind of like not 100%, but a little bit of like an Edgar Wright, like. He had his own ideas, and they were like, we don't want your ideas. We're fine with our ideas. And so I'm interested to see how much of, cause I do feel like even in something like this, there is those moments of the Raimi stuff kind of pops up. So I'm interested to see if he gets to do any of that in Doctor Strange, if it's just going to feel like it could have been directed by anybody.
I think it's going to have Raimi vibes too.
I hope so. Because he even did that in Spider-Man.
Well, I was thinking Oz. I was thinking Oz because it's like more like the Disney. Was it Disney? It feels like it would be a Disney.
It was Disney.
He had a lot of that Raimi style in it too. Obviously, the biggest, I think, thing to carry over into Spider-Man would be the tentacle scene from Spider-Man 2, because it's 100% feels like something from Evil Dead. Like, it has that same camera work. It's probably one of my favorite scenes ever.
Yeah.
It's just like this small moment of like a horror movie in like this kids movie. I mean, it's not necessarily just for kids, but it's a fun superhero movie with a horror element. I think he keeps throwing them actually in all the Spider-Man movies. He has like these elements of horror. I think of like, I had just recently rewatched the 2002 Spider-Man because I'm starting my big long Spider-Man watch to Spider-Man No Way Home. And that moment where, like, there's a lot of stuff with Willem Dafoe where it's just like a horror film. Like, I like when he's pretending to be the old lady and, like, jumps out and tries to attack him. Or I'd seen something recently, too, where somebody was talking about Spider-Man 3. And when Venom comes down and like grabs Spider-Man, like it's like something out of a horror film too. Like, he has no idea that he's there and he grabs him.
Yeah.
So Raimi loves horror, so I think that it's gonna play into Doctor Strange. And I don't know what it's gonna happen. I know we had a lot of Tobey Maguire rumors. By the time this is out, Spider-Man No Way Home will be out. I'm sure the rumors will be proven true or false by that point. But I think it would be really cool because the very next movie is Doctor Strange. I think, right? March or something? There's no other Marvel movies between them.
I don't think so.
I think that it would be great if he like somehow got Tobey Maguire's Spider-Man back just for his Doctor Strange movie.
Oh, that would be good.
I don't know.
It would make
it
sense.
It seems in the realm of possibility that it would happen.
I mean, it's still the multiverse, so, you know, even though Spider-Man's dealing with the multiverse a little bit, I guess, too, that's what the next Doctor Strange is, the multiverse of madness. So it's not out of the realm of possibility.
No, and I feel like that whatever the post-credit scene is going to be all for Doctor Strange.
Yeah.
That's what I imagine.
I hope at some point in the next Spider-Man movie, they do the same thing that they did in Into the Spider-Verse and recreate the Spider-Man pointing at himself meme in live action.
I feel like they might.
I really hope they do, because that's such a perfect, that's such a good joke. I loved Into the Spider-Verse. I love that movie so much, but that still might have been my absolute favorite thing, was just when the movie ends and the post-credits scene is him going all the way back to the beginning, and it's just two spider, and they're recreating the meme perfectly. That moment always makes me laugh every time I watch that movie again.
I think they have to have it. It's got to be like that perfect moment.
I feel like you have to. Yeah.
It's really weird. I like the character. I maybe liked him more because of what Raimi did with the character. This movie is weird, though. Like, I don't think that the trailers really haven't, like, won me over. It's like certain things. Like, I watched the Matrix trailer and I'm like pumped for the Matrix.
Yeah.
But I watched the Spider-Man trailer and I'm like, it seems like such a mess. Like, they're trying so hard to, like, not reveal what is happening in the story.
I feel like that's just Marvel trailers in general, because we know that they have a history of editing things to throw you off. Like, what was from Infinity War, where they're all running together, including the Hulk, which we learned, like, as soon as you watch the movie, that the Hulk's not even in the movie because Bruce Banner still can't transform, but he's 100% in that trailer. So I feel like that's just...
I was going to say, Holland said too that when he was working with, why can't I think of his name? Alfred Molina. Molina was like happy that he didn't have to have like the tentacles, because when he did Spider-Man 2, they were all actually puppetry.
Practical, yeah.
But they actually, I think, hold up very well for the fact that they were practical. Like, it makes them 100%.
They still look really good. They did a... They were doing, that was on one of the recent episodes on YouTube, the Corridor Digital guys that do their reacting to CGI, and they kind of broke down all of the, they were specifically breaking down Spider-Man 2, so they did Spider-Man 2 from each version of it, and they were bringing up all those facts, and like, they showed like the video of the guy
that
like,
all three Spider-Man 2s?
Yes, that was the whole joke, is that they just did Spider-Man 2 for that one, and they were like showing the guy that, they had like one guy that his whole purpose was just to specifically puppet just the very end so that like it could pick things up. And like, mm-hmm. he's in this giant rig that like just does one thing. So it's like,
yeah, he like pinches the like little thing that it's trying to grab.
That's another great moment. Like you were saying, like how he throws horror elements into that scene where the arms all come to life in the operating room is 100% like a horror movie, you know. Almost feels like the thing with like the tentacles just like shooting out and like murdering people and grabbing them.
It murders like every doctor that's there. And then he's back, just chilling. Yeah, I'm interested to see how it all plays out.
Yeah.
And I'm excited to have some break, like a small little break from work at least, so I can watch all these Spider-Man movies, and then I'll watch all the Matrix movies, which... Thank God there's not that many.
Yeah.
I could watch the Animatrix too. It's been a while since I've watched that. That's probably been the longest.
I was about to say, I almost like can't remember anything from the Animatrix because I've only watched it one time.
There's a few that stand out for me. The one was like the Renaissance, but that was like two parts, and it basically was the story about why the robots had the uprising in the beginning.
Yeah.
Which was exactly what you would imagine it would be, that people just didn't treat robots very good.
Yeah.
And then I remember one where it was like about a runner, and he basically got so much adrenaline and like he like went so fast that he like was like breaking out. He like broke out of the Matrix.
Yeah.
he woke up in a different way, which I thought was kind of cool. But yeah, we'll see. I think I watched the new trailer for that, and I'm like, I'm really excited. Can it let me down? Absolutely. But my biggest excitement, the things I'm most excited for would probably be that, and I'm really excited for a new Scream. I really liked Ready or Not, and I don't know, it's just a series that so far all of them I enjoy.
Yeah.
But that's not what we're doing next.
No. Again, one more snowed-in film.
And then that, something big, I guess.
Yeah.
I guess not, I guess. Definitely big.
It's kind of big.
It's kind of a big deal. Well, overall, you'd recommend this movie to anybody. That's what you said. I would, too. It's a weird one because I don't think it does represent Sam Raimi well. It shows that he's a talented guy, for sure.
Yeah.
But it also has that, like, if you watch that movie without credits, you would never, in your right mind, probably pick out Sam Raimi or Danny Elfman. You would probably not realize that either had anything to do with that movie.
Yeah.
But yeah, I would actually like more of something like that. Well, it sounds like, too, I think you brought up how the new Tragedy of Macbeth is just Joel Cohen again.
Yeah.
And it sounded like Ethan kind of wants a break or is not as interested in it anymore. Maybe he teams up with Sam Raimi. That's his brother, his new brother. Because their relationship goes back way far. Because yeah. He's in Miller's Crossing with them, and I think he popped up a few times as an actor.
Yeah, they wrote Crime Wave for him, or with him, I guess. He's a co-writer on it, too.
See? I didn't even think they really grew up together, but maybe they started around the same time. Because Blood Simple is like early 80s, and The Evil Dead's 81, so yeah. They're probably just all hanging out together.
Yeah. They probably, when their movies were first coming out and, like, playing at festivals or something like that, they probably started working.
Yeah, nowadays
there.
They would just be like me and you. They would just be on a podcast talking about movies.
Yeah.
I guess. I don't know. We'll see. We'll see what comes of Cinema d'Amore. You can follow us on Facebook or Twitter. Twitter. Either or. At Twitter, we're at Cinema d'Amore. And on Facebook, we're /CinemaDamore. That's where we have all our great ads. And you'll get to see the fun ads that Chuck made. Because yeah. Chuck's on ad duty this week.
Yeah.
And next week, we may have a guest. I have to talk to said guest and see if they're still interested in being on it. But I guess you could introduce their next movie, too, if you'd like. Something I haven't seen. That I have wanted to see for years and literally
I feel like this is the movie that I know I for a fact have said it, and I know multiple people that have told you to watch this movie, and you're just like, no, not gonna do it. I'll wait till I have a reason.
It sounded interesting. I bought it last bought it over a year ago, because I bought it when Parasite came out on like Blu-ray almost, or was like up for an Academy Award or something.
Yeah. You call yourself a Bong Joon-ho fan, and you didn't watch his American film in English. You've watched his Korean films.
You know, I don't really know who gets to call me a fan. I still haven't seen everything. There was like Tokyo Stories or something like that, where he does a short film. I haven't seen that one. I don't even think I said the title right.
Yeah.
But I've seen everything else, I think. I think Snowpiercer might be the last one. I'll double check before we do it.
Yeah. This is like your version of A Simple Plan. That was the last Sam Raimi film I needed to see. To have seen all of his filmography, this is the last one you need to. This is the final puzzle piece, and then you'll truly understand Bong Joon-ho.
Well, you know me, I'm probably wrong.
Yeah, there's one random film that's only ever been released in Korea that we literally can't even get in America.
No, it'll be like this. It'll be the easiest one to get, and I haven't watched it. But yeah, that was another good episode, Chuck. I'm glad that we're sounding a lot better. That really means a lot to me.
We figured it out.
I'm so sorry for November.
Just pretend November didn't happen.
I never took the episodes down, but if you want to hear what an awful podcast sounds like, it's our November episodes. Just November 2021.
Remember the 5th of November, except this one. Don't remember that one.
Yep. And I'm trying to get home for Thanksgiving. Planes, Trains, and Automobiles. Nope. Yeah.
Nope. Don't skip Thanksgiving this year.
Yeah. All right. I guess, I think next week's coming out like around Christmas, right?
Christmas Eve.
There you go. Our Christmas Eve episode. There you go.
Yeah.
Snowed in. Thanks, guys.
Thanks.
We are Cinema D'Amore. Follow us on Facebook and Twitter to stay up to date with news and information on upcoming episodes. Find us on Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Podbean, Spotify, Amazon Music, Audible, Pandora, Alexa, or iHeartRadio. It would be greatly appreciated if you subscribe to our podcast on your platform of choice. We also appreciate feedback, so rate us, review us, and let us know what you think. And above all else, thank you for listening.